had to go about it, write it out and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you. It's the Final Word Cricket Podcast with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon. And the reason there's a bit of an echo in the room is we're sitting
echo.
What do you call it? A conference centre, a boardroom of sorts. Mm-hmm. Not quite a boardroom, not quite that flash.
It's the boardroom. We're taking this straight to the top, Collins.
I want those
reports on my desk last week.
And it's not quite the Athletes' Village either. We're in the inner sanctum. Yeah. We are inside the security canopy where the players and officials are, which we've been admitted into to do an interview.
There's not an Athletes' Village because they kept it dispersed. So it was, I think, to avoid everybody getting COVID back when they were actually worried about those sort of things. I think maybe that was a deal. But let's just give you a peek behind the curtain. We had to come to this hotel, go to a security tent, give them our passes, at which point someone went up the stairs to the fourth floor to get a temporary pass to bring it down to us, to give it to us, and then accompany us back up to the same place where we gave it back to the person who'd just given it to them in order to take one lift four floors.
Yeah.
And then be parked at this table just next to the desk where we gave the passes back to the people who gave them to us. So it's been good.
It reminds me of my experience a decade ago working on the London Olympic Games. I had 100 people working for me, a combination of paid staff and volunteers at my venue at Earls Court, across the Rosebery, across the fortnight. And it's reasonable to say that at different points through the fortnight, people were scratching around for stuff to do because you get in a rhythm and, you know.
Sure.
And there were all of these procedures and protocol around everything. Mm-hmm. And when push came to shove, you know, major events are overstaffed and thus everyone's looking for something to do.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that I was going to raise an interesting anecdote from that, but I thought actually it might not be in my interest long term to talk about one of the stories I was going to tell then. Anyway, but yes, a privilege to be here. And the reason we are here is, as you all know, if you've clicked the link on the show, we have interviewed Catherine Brunt. We've just finished chatting to her for about 45 minutes or thereabouts. We could have spoken to her for 4.5 hours. She's that kind of character. She's an absolute beauty. I'm sure you're going to love this chat. And predictably, she's got a lot to say.
Yeah. Sometimes you sit down with people who are ready and willing to talk. And I love how open she's willing to be about her life and herself now. And it felt like sitting down with an old friend and just having a chat.
All right. We'll reflect on the interview once we've played it out. Let's do that now. This is The Final Word with Catherine Brunt. Enjoy. We are at the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. Opposite us, in a conference room style thing, is the great Catherine Brunt at the Commonwealth Games for the first time, with, of course, cricket in this tournament for the first time, for women anyway. You couldn't have possibly imagined playing in a tournament like this when your career started way back when, could you?
Absolutely not. I didn't think it was a possibility either. It's not even come to my mind where I would have that in my head saying, let's push it forward, let's try and get this happening or anything. It just never even entered my head. I think just watching people on TV from the Commonwealth Games, Olympics, was just a pretty awesome, exciting thing. I'm also actually geeking out in my room watching all the other sports currently this week. So, it's awesome and I'm very happy to be here.
Talk to me about the opening ceremony and just sort of being part of something like that, walking out with, I guess, teammates, but family too, right? I mean, it's such a tight-knit group and all the rest of it, and then sort of being there in front of the world's media with all these other athletes, like, take us to that place.
Danny Wyatt was like, oh, I've got a trick. Stick to the outside. Stick to the right. You'll get on camera. I was like, right, let's do
of
this.
Of course you said that.
Let's get the family's, reactions. Let's get some pictures. So we went to the right. Off we go around. And there it is, a big fat camera in our face. So what do we do? Like children, we're like, ah, just like waving at it. And then literally an hour after it finished, I got my phone and there they are, all the pitch screenshots. Yes. The family saying, you got on, yes. And I was like, just follow Danny Wyatt, she knows everything.
It is quite remarkable, like, given you must have spent thousands of hours on television playing cricket games over the journey, you still get excited when you see a camera.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, BBC, innit? We're loving it. It just felt almost a bit surreal, I think. We were definitely fangirling everything that was happening that day, and it was an enormous occasion, and we were just trying to have fun, just be happy, smile and enjoy and take it all in, because not often you get to do stuff like that. You don't feel like it's, when you go to World Cups and stuff, we don't really function like that. I think this is the first time we've kind of functioned differently in a tournament where it all just feels a little bit bigger and a little bit more crazy. So
it's not just about you and your team and what you're doing.
Exactly. Yeah, you're the ants in this big board game.
Does that kind of take pressure off in a way, because it's you're lost in the bigger picture? You're just one part of the bigger picture.
Absolutely. And it's not just about, like, obviously if you get to a final it's brilliant, but you can still come third and be celebrated. How good is that? Whereas you come second, you don't win, you don't get the first place, you're a loser. So that just in itself is great.
Yeah, that's right. Very different. I mean, if you're a losing finalist in a World Cup, which you've been like a lot of times, no one celebrates that. You know, you're the first loser, not the second winner, if you know what I mean. The Olympic Games and Commonwealth Games certainly have a different energy. And, you know, and whilst you might be, you know, comparatively a smaller ant in this thing, to use Jeff's words from before, a lot of attention on you in the build-up to these Commonwealth Games, about your preparation for it, about how well you bowled against South Africa, but not playing the test match, retiring from that format of the game, your age, of course, being 37 now. There was a milestone game that you played in to start the comp. I mean, it has been a lot about Catherine Brunt, hasn't it?
It has, and I wish you'd all shut up. no, I'm joking. I mean, there is going to be attention, like you said, for obvious reasons. Like, I've had milestones just so happen to come all at the same time. I am the oldest person in the team of literally 17-year-olds. There are things that make me stand out, and I'm still taking the new ball. So obviously, if I do something with that, I'll create attention. And I'm not one that hates it. I do like to get on with my job quite quietly and under the radar, but it's not going to affect me. If anything, the kids... shouldn't call them kids, they hate that. The youngsters, the younger generation are taking the pressure.
Future.
Yeah, they're taking it off me, to be fair, because it's kind of pressure on them now to come in and perform. Like, they've come in and as 17, 19-year-olds and taking Anya's job, who's done it for, you know, 14 years. So they've got to kind of replicate what she did all of a sudden just now. So, and they are, and they're doing a fabulous job, and I'm loving being alongside it, to be honest. It's given me that new lease of life.
You talked about doing something with the new ball, and you did. I mean, you couldn't have lined it up much better than 100th T20 game for England. You get the special embroidered cap, you know, all that kind of business that they like to do these days. Yeah. Have a little cry. Then you go out to bowl.
Damn,
you spotted that. You tried to hide it in the cap, but, you know, the prying eyes of the TV cameras are everywhere. You weren't waving at the cameras at that point. And then you come on to bowl, and then bang, first ball, wicket. I mean, it was pretty fun. Like, it was fun just watching it. It must have been fun doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I was at the top of the mark, actually. I had a little moment. And I went to Darren Goff. It's no secret, everyone knows I modelled my action on him, and I loved watching him when I was a kid because he was mental like me. But I was at the top of my mark, and I was like, right, how do I open this games? I got a swinging ball here, and you have to use the swing. But swing is more of an absolute key for the in-swingers. You got it, as if you're an in-swinger, you've got to use that swing. That's what females, for some reason, find it really difficult, the ball coming back in. For me, away swing, in my head, as an away swinger, you can sometimes swing the ball into the arc of a batter, and that gives them a free, their arms. If there's no pace or bounce in the wicket, it's just like a freebie, and it's like, thanks for coming. Especially if you've got a slip in there, no cover. It's like, do I want to open up my games potentially giving this person a freebie? No, I'm going to go to Darren Goff. What did he used to do? Darren Goff used to running and bowl the one that nips back in as his first ball, just to get himself into his spell, because he felt like that settled him down. He'd know, like, what was coming out then, what his wrist felt like, what his actions, how that's tracking, what the pitch is tracking like. So I said, I'm going to bowl the one that comes back in. I'm just going to get myself in, take the edge off, settle the nerves. And it worked, and I was, delighted.
Yeah, what a way to do it. It's interesting hearing you talk about the nip backer as like the nerve settler.
Yeah.
When historically, I mean, there's something...
It's like the stiff drink of bowling.
The stiff drink of bowling. When historically, I mean, the stock delivery for an outswing bowler, which, you know, you've made an art form for, well, an international career that spans nearly two decades.
Yeah.
I've always had a bit of a theory that there's something more artistic about outswings. You're bringing the slips into play.
Yeah.
It's always a beautiful way to get a player out, caught behind or caught in the cord. And whereas the inswinger, if it goes wrong, it tends to like runs with fewer fielders on the onside. But that you sort of see that nip backer as the one that can kind of get you into the groove. And I like how you mentioned Darren Goff there as well. Similar part of the world that you grew up in, of course.
Yeah.
You being the Barnsley Express. Let's go back there. Let's go all the way back to the start. You and your five siblings and playing with your brothers in the nets at Barnsley Cricket Club. Your dad playing on a Saturday. And where you first fall in love with the game.
Yeah, I was about eight. I'm not going to say I remember much before then, but certainly thought about cricket before then. Daniel is 3.5 years older than me, and he's the one, I'm the youngest, he's the next one up. The rest of them had nothing to do with cricket, to be honest. There's a couple of cross-country runners in there, and so on. Some really intelligent siblings, like the brainiacs, and then you got me and Daniel. He would kill me for saying he wasn't intelligent. He is, don't get me wrong. But
lucky nobody listens to this podcast, yeah. Catherine.
But we were the... Yeah, he would definitely listen to this. But we were the sporty ones, and anything he did, I wanted to do or be. So, I mean, he could have wanted to be an astronaut, and I wanted to be an astronaut or anything.
Right.
I just looked it up to him so much. And I always thought that I could. I never doubted myself, which is absurd, because he was so much bigger than me. I was a little kid, and he used to like dominate me at everything. But I always thought I was in with a chance for some reason. So playing basketball, playing pillow rugby in the living room, whatever it was, I'd compete. And that's where I've got my, I guess, my pizzazz and my, you know, my passion, my fire, certainly, from just being wound up off the scale by our Daniel. So I soon learned in the back garden the arts of cricket and swing bowling, because everybody knows the wind ball is an excellent ball, especially when taped up with electrical tape, which Daniel showed me. And so when he kept smashing me back over my head into the school field and making me fetch it, I soon got bored of that, and I wanted to find a way where I didn't have to do that as often. So he then showed us, I'll make it a bit easier for you, our kid, and taped up the ball, showed me how to swing it, and I would try other things like knocking his head off, short pitch bowling. Or I'd say, let's play off 15 yards. I think 19 is a bit harsh for a 10-year-old, you know. And so he just went from there. And actually, when I actually later on in life went to women's cricket, I found it so easy. I was like, this is a breeze, because, you know, my brother's been terrorising me for years already. And, you know, I quite like this. This is, you know, laid back Catherine. So, yeah, that's where it all started and kind of how it went on.
How does pillow rugby work?
So you stuff it up your top and then you just run into each other as fast as you possibly can. I wouldn't recommend it. Like, let's not be trying that at home, anyone.
Yeah.
But it was good fun at the time.
Yeah, I used to play a version of that game. I think we called it Momentum. You were just like, you just yell, Momentum, and crash into each other. It was good.
Our version was getting the cushions from the couch and boxing.
Oh, yeah.
In the absence of boxing gloves, my brother and I would hit the suitcase out of each other with the...
suitcase, you just mentioned that. We used to go down the stairs in that. Get in the suitcase and off you go.
And the Barnsley toboggan.
But into the... Unfortunately, there's a wall at the bottom on the bend.
There was for a while.
Yeah, into that. Good fun, good times.
Have Barnsley ever, you know, given you, like, the keys to the city or something? Because I feel like you've done more to make that town famous than anywhere, because it gets attached to your nickname. Suddenly, for free publicity, everyone's heard of Barnsley, even if they haven't been to Barnsley.
Funny you should say that. I got the keys this year.
Did you?
Yes. As soon as I got back from the World Cup, I am, you know, an honorary member now. It didn't get me any free coffees or discount in stores, but which I'm a bit sad about. But
is it a literal key? Like,
it's
give
a
you an
scroll.
Actual key?
It's a leather scroll.
Is it the freedom of the city?
It is freedom of the city.
So
apparently.
That means you. Is there any? I know historically you couldn't be arrested. Yeah. Does that hold to this day?
I think the only person that you would know than me is Dickie Bird.
Right.
He got it. It's actually got a statue, so I'm waiting for my statue.
Okay.
If that would be nice.
It'll work. A statue of you appealing and him shaking his head.
Yeah, because Dickie Bird's like this. And every now and then somebody puts some knickers on his finger, which is a bit so I'd probably prefer not to be like this.
Maybe it could be you, or maybe it could be you down there giving it to him, having not given a dismissal.
Yes.
Given it's kind of your.
Sounds about right.
And I suppose it's always been your way, hasn't it? Certainly as long as I followed your career, you've been one that gets fired up. You said something before and I nearly jumped in and you go, I just like to go about my work quietly. Really? I'm not sure about that.
Not when I'm on the pitch.
But going back to sort of, again, the start, and you know, you're through the Yorkshire age groups, it's clear you're probably going to play for England on the trajectory that you're on, but then you take quite a significant break from the game in 2002 for a couple of years, which you've spoken about. You struggled with your body, you struggled with your weight, all the sensitivity that goes hand in glove with something like that. Have you had a chance sort of 20 years later to think about how it was for you at that time? I know you've been quite open about your mental health, but about that particular moment, because it could go either way when you're at that formative age, can't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty fragile back then. I looked up to all my brothers and sisters massively, and so if they had something to say, I would listen. I still do. And at that time, I had my sister with me, who had gone through similar struggles, not the bullying or anything, but certainly the weight issues, probably a bit more severe than me, which I won't go into. But that was nice. It's not nice, but it's good to have someone to see that in and know. And she moved forward. She got better and she did great. She did great going forward from that. And so I followed that as well. And that developed, you know, doing things on your own, achieving things on your own, give you the will and the motivation you need growing forward as an adult. And so I was in a slightly stronger position when I got to 2002 to make that decision to play for England, because she was like, Claire Connor came up to me and said, based on that Yorkshire year I'd had for Yorkshire, I was a standout bowler, and she had this list of bowlers, and she went, we've got an injury and we'd love you to come and play in this tour. And I was like, what the, I don't want to do that, scary as. also not ready, but yeah, I just thought, wow, what an offer, like, but nah, don't want to, like, I just didn't have any ambitions to play for England or be on that kind of stage, or
right.
I'd not even heard of an England women's team. I didn't know it was real or anything. I didn't know they were wearing skirts either. I would have been a clear no. And so my sister, Claire walked off, and my sister just like pulled me to one side. She's like, what are you doing? I was like, what do you mean? I just don't want to. She's like, you're gonna make the biggest mistake of your whole life. She's like, why won't you do it? And I said, well, we've got tickets. I think it was to Glastonbury. I always say East Festival, but I think it was Glasto. I was like, I want to go. Like, and I've got my driving test coming up or something. And she's like, are you having a laugh? She was like, we can sell those and you can go every year after this if you want. I'll buy them. Mm-hmm. But you have to say yes. And I was like, oh, fine. So I just like marched up to Claire and I was like, I'll play.
And fine, you talked me into it.
Fine. And then literally from that moment on, I never looked back. And it was the best decision I ever made. Thank you, and Rachel.
You probably never got to Glastonbury again either, because you
I
always would have
never
been training
been to
or
Glastonbury.
Playing.
I've been to the V Festival once on a year where I was injured.
Right.
It's grand.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much impossible with the
is.
Life that you've had.
Yeah, that is part of it, isn't it, when you commit to being... I know you weren't a professional cricketer then, but you know, an international cricketer, and later down the track a professional, that it gets lost a bit, that you miss out on pretty normal stuff that kids get to do in those years when you're able to make a few more mistakes privately. Well, your mistakes are more in the public eye, you know, because that's just the nature of being an athlete playing for your country. If you stuff up at a festival and get in trouble, whatever. And other things as well, like, you know, who you get to hang out with in your own time and the types of experiences. Like, I know you're well beyond that now. We're the same age and I feel like that's a long, long part of my previous life. But you don't get quite that opportunity. You're very much drilled into playing cricket. And by 2004, when you're 20-odd, you're playing Test cricket against New Zealand. I mean, it doesn't take long for you to be on the big stage.
Yeah, I was 21, I think. But, I mean, you know me, I'm quite immature. And I honestly, sometimes, if someone just listened to me and didn't see me or know my age, they'd probably think I was 17. So, like, and I don't dislike that. I love being young at heart.
Yeah.
I could put that down to why I'm still here, because I'm still fresh in my head and daft about most stuff. So You can imagine how young I was at 21. I was actually the quietest person in the team then.
Really?
Which is obviously completely opposite now.
Right. How did that happen? How did you, I mean, was that you?
Everyone was terrifying.
Yeah,
everyone was so
really
old.
Shy,
in that.
Right?
We had a fair few 30-odd-year-olds and who are now teachers as well. They're a little bit terrifying. Claire Taylor, she was straight face, work extremely hard. There was a lot of proper working hard people there.
Claire and Connor was a teacher too.
Yeah, exactly. And
so it was
Lucy
like you're sitting in a room of schoolmistresses.
Yeah.
As far as you were
the
concerned.
Person I was meant to take over was Lucy Pearson. She's 6 foot three and is a teacher at Wellington Private School. Like, these people were really intimidating, and I was this little fish in a big pond. And I mean, they intimidated me, but the sport didn't, and the competition
right.
didn't. But it was pretty cool. Being amongst them, I learned a lot of lessons from them. They were great.
I've got a lot of disreputable friends, like in their 40s and stuff, who still go to Glastonbury and so on every year. So, like, you can still do that. Like, that time in your life can still come.
Catch up.
I just want to reassure you. Like,
yeah, it's
you
true.
Can,
like,
you can be act like a 20-year-old at 45 now. It's fine.
I won't be shamed in being the old person at concerts.
Yeah. But there'll be plenty of others, is all I'm
saying. Yeah.
You won't be on your own.
So you come back and make that leap to be an England player. You're super fit. You're very quick. You know, you have the reputation of being the fastest bowler in the country pretty early on. Get some early World Cup exposure. Doesn't go particularly well. Then there's the 2005 Ashes. You know, that's this breakthrough moment for you in your career. 14 wickets in two Test matches. And the critical half century you make with Isha. We've spoken to Isha on this podcast about that before, that partnership that goes on to secure the Ashes for England against Australia for the first time in 42 years. Mm. You know, suddenly you're in Trafalgar Square and all the rest that goes hand in hand with that, with the men's team having beaten Australia. You've beaten Australia. You've taken 14 wickets and been a real presence. Do you often think about that? Does it seem like a dream that you were part of that parade
Isha,
through the streets of London?
We don't stop bringing it up, to be fair, even though it's 1,000 years ago. She loved that. We loved it. We got to go into the nets. As like openers, obviously, because we went overnight, and we're like, yeah, we'll go in the nets and we'll make Claire Taylor have like 100 throwdowns to us, because the players did throwdowns for each other then,
right?
And I was used to giving loads of throwdowns to obviously the senior players, so me and Isha were lapping it up. We must have had a hit that morning before we went back on for like an hour and a half. We were like, just pepper us, come on, pepper us, because that's what Fitzpatrick wanted to do at the time. She's bloody terrifying, and I'm not sure there's been anyone scarier since, I'm going to be honest. Flamenic is up there, but she was, you know, blonde mullet charging in, you know, telling you to cheer up Charlie every 5 minutes and wrapping you in the ribs. It was we were having an absolute ball. It was great fun. We knew it wasn't on us to save this test match. Whatever we did, it wouldn't be our fault. We were 10 and 11, like, how could it be? It's not on us. But what we did is we really wanted it. We were enjoying it, and we saw it as this huge battle. I was like, I'll be dead before she gets me out. Like, there was somebody, every tour I've ever been on, I've always picked someone that I go into battle with, whether it's Elise Perry, Sophie Devine, whoever, Atapatu. I've always got to be better. Yeah,
Shefali
Verma. I've got to have a battle. I've got to get into the battle. But I've also, then the aim is to be better than what they were that day.
Yep.
And so she was the person who was terrorising everyone. And everyone was saying how scared they were of her. So I was like, well, I won't be scared, and I will be better than you in this game. And I made it my life's mission to be better. And so, like, the way I bat or bowl had this real meaning to it. And Ish was just having a... She'll never forgive me for not letting her get her 50. I made a bad decision on a sweep and got out when she was on 38, and she'll never forgive me, but... That was has and always will be one of the hardest times to replace in terms of how it felt and the moment and the fun and the, because it was one of the last times where I was allowed to be completely free and without any fear of failure or anxiety. That was the last time I probably felt without those feelings, because that's what professional cricket does now.
Right.
It brings that added bit of expectation, anxiety, and feeling sick and sleepless nights. And you do grow up, things do start becoming more serious, and you do start playing for your career and the security around you. And there's just always more. But that was the last time I remember being a kid and just, I don't know, living life without any worries.
Like this overlap period of being able to do both, to play and to be a kid.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And it's not long before you, you know, have to go through the ringer of having injuries starting to infect your career, the back injury especially, which means you miss an Ashes series. You know, it takes a lot to recover from that. Give us a sense of the lengths you had to go to at a pretty young age to make sure your back was fit to continue on being what you needed to be as England spearhead. Yeah.
To be honest, unless you've been through a serious injury, it's like one of the darkest places you can ever be. It's hard to describe like where you have to go in your head to keep going, because, and Heather's experiencing it a little bit now, but feeling pain all day, every day, and not knowing when it's going to end is like one of the worst things ever. Like, I remember one time just walking around my kitchen island at 2 o'clock in the morning, just walking around it and round it and round it and banging on it, and just to change this feeling. And then just like banging my head on the bifold doors. It's like, that sounds so messed up, but it's hard. It's like 9 weeks straight of just pain, constant, without, there's no switch off. I think the only time of relief was like between 11 and 2 during the day, where I'd start to feel a little bit more myself. Still there, but yeah, it was extremely difficult, but it gave me like this enormous amount of resilience, and suddenly I knew what lengths I could go to and how far I could stretch myself.
And like when you're up against something, you already know that you've done something harder.
Yeah, like nothing could be worse than this fact. Like, so the next time it happened, like I knew I could get through it. But
right, like it's something I think about quite a bit with the way that human minds work, that a lack of surety is like the hardest thing for us to deal with. You know, if someone says you're going to be in agony for 9 weeks and you know it's going to be 9 weeks, then you can kind of deal with that. But when it's just, this could be forever. It might not be. It might stop sometime. Yeah. It might stop in 2 days. Like, it could be over, but it's just not knowing, right?
Yeah.
Like getting delayed at an airport for 6 hours is annoying, but getting delayed when you don't know when the delay is going to end, that's when people go crazy, when they don't. It's just not being able to be sure about the future.
That's the absolute facts. Like, that is the biggest part of it. And then on, I think on top of that was the, will I ever be the same again? I think I did. I definitely did lose some of myself that first time round. I definitely didn't come back the way I started. I'd say like a good 10% of me was left behind at that 2005 Ashes.
Wow.
And between the end of that injury to now, it happened again in 2014, and the same thing. I've been working at 80% since then as well. Like, and it's so sad, because I knew what heights I was reaching, and I did get, there was a period after that first surgery where I got myself back and I was running in at 78 mile an hour, and I broke this Irish girl's arm, and I was feeling like invincible again, and then I started to deteriorate again. And I knew that bowling fast wasn't for me. Like, something had to change.
You couldn't keep doing it.
Yeah, and it's kind of an interesting intersection, because, you know, 2009, it's like the ultimate year for England women's cricket. I mean, you'll have other years where there's been success, but 2009, beat Australia again. Once again, you're instrumental in that, taking 6 for 69 and 9 wickets in a test match. You win the World T20 at Lord's, you know, in front of a big crowd. At one stage, you've got figures of 3 for 6 in the final.
Yeah.
Win the 50-over World Cup at North Sydney Oval. Again, sort of being able to win that for the second time. By that point, you may not be quite so quick, but you hear of bowlers who do have those existential crises early in their career, and they need to find a way to become a different kind of bowler. Someone like Dennis Lilly jumps out, you know, one of the greats all time, who was nowhere near as quick after his back surgery, but became one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Australian fast bowler of all time. There's a comparison there with you, isn't there, that you became a far more resourceful bowler because you had to.
Yeah, and when Robbo came in, he said that to me. He said, you can't, so most of the time, you can't teach an old horse new tricks. Like, and but my character is, am I allowed to swear?
You please.
My character was, well, fuck you, I'll show you. Watch this. And then I gave him 25% more. But good on him. He knew how to get the best out of me. He knew that that challenge would... He also said after, I knew that would either make you or break you.
Right.
And it did right. some people. Some people didn't want to find that extra 20 and they left. I wanted to find that extra 20 because I'm more, fuck you, I will show you. If you doubt me, I'll right. you know, I'll do it, but then I'll do it and then some. So that's what I did in 2008. That's when I was at my quickest. And then just before 2009, I made it more about skill. I was with my almost lifelong coach, Paul Shaw, and I just said I want the swing back. I want just the swing, and I want it to be all about that. I didn't have the other balls then. But I wanted to make that my super strength.
Right.
My accuracy has always been there, and that's what I've prided myself on. But I wanted to make that tournament about my swing because I just thought that's be the how I would be the standout. And the day before that Lord's final, T20 final, I worked for like 2 hours with Paul and got my swing back. And that was where, at the start of me being more skilled and less about just charging in like a tool, right. trying to pull as fast as I can. There is that, I think, and all seamers, I think, will try and flip that switch.
Right. Because Adam talked about it like an existential crisis. Was there that point for you? Because it sounds like when you're a kid, cricket's not that important. Like you play yeah. it, but it's not who you are. Is there that point a few years later where having to change the way you bowl does sort of reflect something about, does it feel like you're losing part of the way you see yourself or like the mm-hmm. identity you've built for yourself in your head and you're having to become a new person, or was it not so enmeshed as that?
Every time I step over the boundary rope, I'm the same person right. on that pitch, as in what you see on the pitch has always been the same person there, but before I step on, that person's changed quite a bit okay. over the years. And I think more because, like I said earlier, it goes from you being a kid and having no worries and no... I forgot the word, but, you know, I mean, your mum and dad take care of everything.
Yeah.
You don't have anything.
No responsibilities.
No responsibilities. And then you turn into a semi-adult who you need to start thinking about a house, maybe. But you've just started playing for England, so you might want to just enjoy that a bit, but actually you've just realised shit's getting real.
Yeah, you know how to use a washing yeah. machine, but sometimes other people do it for you.
Yeah, like I didn't go to uni, so I didn't have the whole, you learn how to cook and clean here, if you fend for yourself. I didn't have that. Kind of still having it done for you. And then, for instance, the first time I ever took my own flight for a holiday, I missed it because I wasn't told where to be at what time.
Right.
And I was like, oh shit, I'm supposed to learn how to be an adult here.
Where's my passport?
Yeah, so like growing up, having failing relationships because you're on tour constantly, or you've got a mortgage but you don't earn enough money to keep that house, so you have two jobs alongside your England role. I actually had three jobs outside of playing cricket for England.
What were you doing before the professional?
I had a coaching job, quite in North Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. I worked with my dad as his PA, and I also worked in town in Barnsley for a legal secretary as right. like the filer. And I love doing stuff. I love earning money. I love like making things happen. Like I'll work as hard as anyone just to get to where I want to be. I have no problem in that.
You were of that generation. We were here with Izzy Wong, you know, half an hour ago. She'll never experience that. Well, she's a professional cricketer. I know she's done other work, but her life will be probably for the foreseeable future running in and bowling for a living, right? Which is what yours has been since 14-15 when the central contracts come in. Pretty convenient time in a way in hindsight because your back flares up again. And, you know, you had that safety net where you had the chance to rehabilitate. You had the chance to get right again. It might well have been the case that if central contracts didn't come in second time around, you might have said, stuff it. Yeah. I mean, I've achieved quite a bit already. I've been an international cricketer for a decade.
Yeah.
A lot of your teammates from that generation were retiring at about 28, 29, 30. You could have been one of them, but instead there's this different life, this second career you can have as a full professional.
Yeah, I mean, I knew I still had more to give, and I knew I was at that time still the best in the world or within that top three, and not being challenged. Like, there wasn't Izzy Wongs and Katie Georges and Tash Farrants and you know, whoever we've got, we seem to have millions.
Production line.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly. Yeah. And it just wasn't there. And I've always said that. Who's here to push me out of my place? Come on, someone. I want that fight. I want it. Yeah, take me on. Like, I have no problem competing with a 19-year-old. But they just weren't. And so I thought, well, I'm not done yet. Even though if I have to go through this again, I'm literally going to jump. Like, it was that awful. So I knew I could go through it, and I knew what it took to come back. And I knew if I came back and it felt all right, I would give it another good crack. And once I started giving it a go, it's like an obsession. Like, it's addictive. Mm. Like, you get to go on the pitch and do the fun part for like 5% of the year. Everything else is training and grueling hard work, but it makes up for it.
It's something like 2017, you know, that World Cup, that day at Lord's, is that a point where you go, okay, everything was worth it?
Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah, like that Robbo era, you know. I think in 2015 is when Australia get away from you a little bit. They have central contracts as well. They have a pretty convincing win in the Women's Ashes over here, and they start doing their own thing. But Robbo comes along and you know, you catch up the Australians in the space of one World Cup cycle, and you have to make shifts inside the team. People like Lottie and Lydia, who you'd, of course, played with a lot, have made way. Robbo does put the acid on players to be fitter. I mean, well documented. He told people, you've got to be fit if you want to play for me. You're explaining the test that he put to you personally. Mm-hmm. Didn't you go on and win the bloody thing at Lord's? I mean, I was thinking about this morning, knowing we were going to come and talk to you about the Lionesses winning last night at Wembley. And we, Jeff and I earlier were discussing it in the context of that being a moment that you can identify with on the basis of what happened in front of a packed Lords in 2017. The game's completely changed. You're well and truly back on the park doing your thing. You're leading the attack. You're winning at Lords, and you're doing it with a new coach, a new captain, and a different environment altogether.
Yeah. I think with Robbo at the time, we knew, God, he made us work.
Yeah.
Like, fuck, those 4 years leading up to that World Cup, it was like, if you want to ever play in a tournament where you have no regrets, fuck, that was it. Like, if we weren't going to win that, then I couldn't have given a shit, because I gave it absolutely freaking everything. Like, my fitness was the best. I was fitter than anyone, stronger than anyone. Like, I took it to the extreme. I took pride in it. Like, because just that pat on the back from Robbo was like gold. It was like, if you got a pat, you're like, oh, I'm excellent. Yeah. So I was like, I made sure I beat Danny Wyatt. She's always been the fittest because she's rapid and all. I beat her in the yo-yos number one, and I won all the strength tests, so I was like buzzing. And then we were training, that's the most we'd ever trained. He had us at Loughborough every week. Everybody was crying on a weekly basis because they were like, oh God, don't send me to Loughborough again for a 4-day grueling camp. And it was just week in, week out, week in, week out. And then the away tours, we'd go to Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and it would just be that, put you in the middle of a desert, so you've got nothing to do but bloody play for cricket against lads, no less. Like, lads, we were playing against like Millfield School, like all these bloody great academies, and they were sometimes trashing us, but sometimes we would win. And so, like I said, we got there and no stone was left unturned, and we knew in terms of skill we might not be as good as Australia, but the fight's always been there. But we knew we'd done absolutely everything we could possibly do to try and win. So I think having that behind us and beating the Aussies in that round on the way was like, that was a turning point.
Yeah, that felt like the belief moment.
Oh,
like
absolutely.
That switch flick.
Yeah.
Catherine, it was a great privilege to interview yourself in that when you announced your engagement back for The Guardian, however many years ago it was now, 2019, and you told a beautiful story to me about being on the balcony of the home dressing room.
Cringe.
At Lord's. It was good though, wasn't it? Home balcony after you've won the World Cup, and that's when you decided to pitch up to Nat and say, you know what?
A bit of Kenny G was playing in the background.
It's time for you to be my girlfriend, or words to that effect. And after you've been, as she puts it, you've been pursuing her for some time, she finally agreed. I mean, it was a great story at the time and so on, but there was also challenges laden in that with what you described to me at the time as your family not being quite so keen on it all. But the idea that you had found your partner in the dressing room, I mean, it's pretty special.
Yeah, well, obviously the cricket takes up a fair bit of your life, and, you know, the people you meet are limited. You don't get to...
Options are...
Sorry, not to say that that was a last resort, but
it sounds like a breakfast buffet at a hotel, right? You're like, well, there's not many options. Guess I'll have this stale croissant.
That's a stale croissant. Weekends are lost growing up. You don't have weekends. You play cricket on a weekend. Yeah. You don't get to go out. Festival clubbing is minimal, like, unless you go to uni and then you're allowed a little weekday time out. But, me travelling the world all year round every year for the last 20 years is kind of how it is. So, naturally, I grew a massive bond with Natalie and we became best friends. And I didn't want to ruin that friendship because obviously everyone knows you take it to the next level, then there's no going back. You can't be best friends after. It's just not a thing, everyone. It's
classic,
not a
premise
thing.
Of every romantic pretend. Comedy has yes. this. Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, do we venture into the unknown?
We can still be friends. No, you cannot. Yeah. So I always, like, Nat always knew, she'll tell you, there's no doubt for her ever. But it was for me, actually, for quite a few, like 4 years, I guess, before I made the right decision. But I'm actually really impatient too, so I thought that was really good of me. I'd never been more sure about anything in my life. She's like the perfect human, as you all aware. Like, yeah, it was the right thing. It was a great day, even though I made it as cringe as possible. But the wedding was fabulous, and I know it also sounds cringe to say it was the best day of my life, but it actually was.
Right.
And I am the tightest northerner ever with my money, but every penny we spent on that was worth it.
Tell me about the wedding.
Well, we went to Prestwold Hall in Loughborough, keeping it local.
Keeping it women's cricket.
Yeah. we've got a dog together, Bella, and we take her around there all the time. And I was like, let's just get married here. Like, we were meant to do it in France, in Chamonix, years ago. COVID ruined that. Finchie, our manager, ruined that. Finchie. The scheduling ruined it. So we were just like, let's do it local. We can get it done. Let's go here. But it was this big grand hall. And I was like, no. They were renovating the barn there. And Nat was like, that's a bit of me. So we had this lovely barn dance all night. Had a COVID mashup. All the players ill the next day.
Oh, no.
But all couldn't play cricket. But actually, it was a good job we all got COVID then, because now we haven't got it in the Commonwealth. And we've got the immunity. So well done, me, for the COVID party.
Perfect. It was like chicken pox parties as a kid.
It was an awesome day. All the cricketers were able to be there, which is great for me, past and present. My brother walked me down the aisle. And it was perfect.
Does sound it. It's like this this mesh between your personal life and your cricketing life. Through that time, I have a recollection of watching you on the back of a golf cart in a hotel in St. Lucia when your back went again, 2018 World Cup. And I think we talked about you in retirement before, but you said something to me at some point or another saying, if we win this World Cup, I might pull the pin because it'll be enough for me. Winning the World T20 will be sufficient for me at that point of your career.
Well, I was in a pretty bad place then.
Yeah, and you explained later, of course, that had really set you back a bit, that missing a World Cup, not really knowing where your cricket would be, you know, fourth time around by this stage with your back, but also having, like, you know, your personal life's going really well. You know, the reason I remember the golf cart was Nat was there for you, you know, as she would be, albeit before the world knew, but, you know, very tight unit within the side. And you've got to go again. You've got to find a way to go back to the well and recover and decide to go back to it. And, I mean, the fact that it's nearly 5 years since then, or 4 years rather, since then, and you're still going strong, I mean, that takes some determination. What has it been that, even though it looked like it might be all over for you in 2018, that's kept you going time and time again?
I've got some pretty good lessons as a kid. Yeah, some hard to talk about. Just got real. Like, being bullied for as long as I can remember as a kid always made me, like, keep turning up. You just got, even though you don't want to, you got to keep turning up. That's just one thing. My dad was a miner for 25 years. He ran to work and ran from work. We never saw him. And just like, if he can do that, Christ, I can train. I can go to training for a couple of hours, even though it hurts. My grandma's job in the war was to identify body parts and send them to the families. Like, do you know what I mean? Jesus. Like, I just feel privileged as a person in what I get to do and what I get to experience. So no matter what I've been through or my family's been through, like, it's always like, you can't complain, you can't, there doesn't seem worthy of quitting or like not doing something that somebody else would wish they could do. So yeah, it never feels bad enough or hard enough to quit, and I think I'm not a quitter, and I won't see it like that when I finish, as quitting. Obviously it will just be that I did the best I could do for as long as I possibly could.
It'll be a graceful exit to Glastonbury.
Get me there.
The troughs that you had with your mental health, like, you know, it sounds like it's cyclical to some point, or it comes and it goes. I mean, this is something that I identify with myself. Is that, do you anticipate that's something that'll keep happening, that you'll have to keep managing through your life from here, or is it?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I can talk about it because I think it's important. Doesn't mean I find it easy, and I don't want to just go into the next room and cry about it. I do. It's just, like I said, it's important that people can identify with it and know that they're not the only person going through it. And to know that you can go through all these shite things and still reach the absolute pinnacles of whatever it is you want to do, they can. And when I have a kid, whenever that might be, because Nat wants them, I'm going to have to go through that with them, and it'll all happen again, and hopefully it won't happen to them. But yeah, that's something that is a possibility, and I know I'm going to be extremely protective, but I've got to learn from my experiences and handle it in the right way. But yeah, like I said, it'll carry with me for the rest of my life. But I think the way I think about it now is in a positive way, and not in that shit dark place where I used to be in.
Right.
I'm mindful that we could keep talking probably about this for an hour or two. You've got places to be, so I'll try and close it up. What would be enough? I mean, I said that back in 2018 you might have considered retirement. You go back and search it. You first started talking about this in 2013. It's a long time to be in one form or another.
What's wrong
at
with
least
me?
Having that as part of your sort of profile, right?
Yeah.
Some cricketers, it's a year or two.
Yeah.
Think of Jimmy,
yeah.
Right? Maybe 3 years. He's
at
40.
This is like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon. Like, yeah. He's talking about packing it in the whole
That's
way
right. I mean, and we've intentionally steered away from retirement speculation, but you did leave Test cricket behind this year after an excellent performance in Canberra that must have been very proud of you, for you, getting beyond 50 Test wickets, and you're probably the last woman who'll ever do that, by the way, which is sad, but that's a whole different debate. But for you, do you feel as though... what would satisfy you walking away now? Is it a particular trophy you're eyeing off?
Yeah.
You know, because you kind of have done it all. So it becomes hard at that point about what's the right dismount? Or are you just waiting for the moment you wake up one day and say, actually, my body doesn't want me to push on? Is it more that, or
no,
is it
that
more
happened
an
this
achievement?
Morning.
happens most mornings, doesn't it?
So the way I think of it is that I do know in the back of my head I'm happy, I'm satisfied. I have done what I wanted to do. I have won the 50 over World Cup, the T20 World Cup, Ashes Series. I've been to number one in the world. I've been to number one all around in the world. You know, I've won series on series and been there for the next generation. I've made the best mates I possibly could in life and got 100 caps in each format and been the leading wicket taker in every format. And I'm just... those things never really ever meant anything to me. I just wanted to steam in, have fun, jump on my mates, scream words of expletives, and just keep doing that and keep traveling the world and being with my mates. Like, I am a lonely, needy person, so I'm going to miss Nat when she's traveling 8 months a year. Maybe the commentary team will have me and I'll be there. But I honestly do feel like I've completed it. If it's a game, I feel like I've completed it. And I don't know what it is that's holding me back. It's some sort of drug, I think. It is quite addictive. And the one thing I did say is I want to keep playing as long as I'm doing myself proud. If I'm playing at any less level, or I'm, you know, one of those people where you go, I think she's done, she needs to... you know, she's not looking her best. She's actually getting worse. I don't ever want to go out like that. I want to be on top of my game. So, yeah.
But maybe if you've achieved all of those things. Maybe this takes you right back to that partnership in that test match when you're a kid, where now you can just play. You don't have to try to achieve any one thing. You don't have to have a particular
goal.
And
I guess that's where I'm at now. Yeah, I'm there now. I think that's why what you've seen in the last 6 weeks has been more me just running in and bowling with freedom. I'm just having fun.
What a wonderful place to be. And indeed a wonderful place to leave it. Catherine Brunt, we love watching you. We love following your career and being involved in it on the sidelines, and so pleased that you're having such a great time of it here at the Commonwealth Games, and best of luck for the rest of the tournament. Thanks for coming on The Final Word and being one of the great characters of our game.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Ebony Rainford-Brennan, and you're listening to The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon.
It's The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins and Catherine Brunt today. Thank you to her for spending some time with us and being all smiles and all heart.
It's always good when you're left wanting more, and I guess, you know, I mentioned in the introduction before that we could have kept talking for quite a long time. You know, there's still more I'm interested to ask her about, maybe the end of the Mark Robinson era, not in a negative way, but just to kind of get her sense of that, the motivation to push through the pandemic when she spent months, what felt like months, in that Derbyshire travel lodge, which I know drove a lot of them slightly crazy, and how tough that was, missing her wedding. And, you know, all of that must have been so taxing on someone who'd played so much international cricket. And as she documented in the interview, you know, there are these moments in her life when it was all very tough to keep getting up. Then the lockdowns and so on, it can only be worse.
There's the Sartre, hell is other people. I think more likely hell is a Derbyshire travel lodge.
Yes.
Probably if you go down the flamey elevator, it opens and that's where you are.
And even the fact that World Cup, when it finished in February, March, wasn't it? March this year in Christchurch. That's the last time she was on the field with Anya Shrubsole. You know, and we spoke to Anya about her relationship with Catherine, but yeah, time meant we didn't quite get the chance to return serve there. But an exercise in contrast as people, but so effective together. And now I think it's lovely that she gets to usher in that next generation that she referred to. Mm-hmm. Someone like Izzy Wong, we got to watch them being interviewed before we spoke to Catherine, and you know, they clearly bounce off each other. There's great energy, and you know that Izzy Wong's going to be the successor to Catherine Brunt. They've got that lined up now, and that's a great thing.
I mean, being there for that, that must be part of what give someone the energy to say, I want to keep doing this. It must be exciting to feel this freshening up, you know, to feel like you're part of growth, you know, to see you always use the phrase of green shoots, you know, but there's something thrilling about seeing literal when you go into your garden and you see new fronds growing from something that you want it to be growing from, not something you don't want it to be growing from. There is something life affirming about that. You're literally watching life do the thing that it does. You're watching life flourish.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that last answer that she gave about feeling like she's a kid bowling in 2005 again before the first round of back injuries, I thought before speaking to her today that if England win the gold medal next week, that she'll retire. My instinct was that she's told me before in other interviews, I'll consider retirement if 2017-18 Women's Ashes. I mentioned there's interviews back to 2013-14 around the back injury. 2018 World Cup, which she didn't participate in because of her back. You know, maybe even the 2019 Ashes, she said something like this as well. There have been moments in time she's like, well, if we do that, then that will be enough for me. Mm. I thought the Comm Games might be one of those. Mm. Now I'm not quite so sure, having talked to her. She might be doing what Jimmy Anderson's doing, and in 3 years' time, convincing the world still, proving to the world over and over again that she is the best going around, and therefore why would you move on? It feels like that might be in her future. Well, just a gut feel.
That's the thing. And there is an obsession in sports coverage about retirements. It's all debuts and retirements. Oh, sure. New player. Oh, when are they going to leave? You know, because it gives you something to talk about. You don't have to retire at a certain point. It doesn't have to be about achieving a certain thing. And so if you've achieved a suite of things across your career, but all you actually want to do is play. You know, we see so many players who retire from the top level but go on to play at a level down for a longer period of time because they want to keep playing. So why not, if you're good enough to play at the top, why not keep playing at the top?
And I suppose you could. That's the beauty of the domestic structure that's now in place. It lets you go up and down the pyramid. The way that Anya Shrubsole's done so well at the Southern Vipers this year as an assistant coach. That's another thing. What will Catherine Brunt be doing in 5 years' time if not bowling? I think she probably will be commentating. She was working on commentary through different parts of the test match and I think a couple of the one days where she didn't play against South Africa when they were managing her with the rotations ahead of the Commonwealth Games stretch of cricket. And she's clearly a natural in front of the microphone, in front of the camera. She's got great sense of timing as a communicator, so maybe it will be the case that she steps from cricket field to commentary box fairly seamlessly.
Maybe she'll be filing for a legal secretary.
Maybe she will.
She's not shy about hard work.
Yeah, I like all of that. But yeah, maybe what you're saying there about this fixation on retirement, it was more of a thing because she made it a bit of a thing. And now that she's detached from that and detached from that needing that next mountain to climb, she's satisfied. She's climbed all of the mountains. It's all about, it's the cream now, isn't it? It's the enjoyment she derives from what's left.
It's literally living in the moment, you know, not worrying about the ambition, the thing to attain or what has happened before. It's just enjoying existence as it happens, you know, which is something that people keep reminding themselves to do all the time. But yeah, it's just a more general thing that with any player, with any career, basically as soon as they're, in cricket, once someone's 31, we go, ooh, could be retiring soon, you know. And yeah, some of them do, but some of them don't. But from 31 to say 40, if you're James Anderson, retirement, that's 80% of everything that is written about you is, maybe this will be his last visit to this country. Like, maybe it won't. Maybe shut the fuck up. I don't know. Maybe get something more interesting to talk about.
So it does mean that we end the interview on a good note, on a high point there. Thanks to everybody for listening. Of course, this precedes our Storytime 100, which comes out probably on Saturday. We've already recorded that. That was loads of fun. We had it with a studio audience of sorts with our patrons and Discord pals there with us on Zoom. If you like what we do, if you like these kinds of interviews and you want us to do more of them and generally get around the world enjoying what we do as a podcast, patreon.com/thefinalword makes an enormous difference. It makes all the difference to other supporters of ours, including Woodstock Cricket. If you want a new bat, woodstockcricket.co.uk. TFW20 is the offer code. advancedstudio.com/finalword for your 15% off with them. We're grateful for everybody who helps get us on the park. At the moment, 8 days a week, literally. Mm-hmm. 8 days a week.
Oh, I need your love, man. Yeah. Sometimes nine. I think we have done up to nine shows a week in some weeks, depending when test matches are overlapping and all the rest of it. Commonwealth Games dailies going on with me and Natalie Germanos, who's been a great sport as well. And well, on and on we go. The final word, can't stop, won't stop.
Can't stop, won't stop. Bad Producer Productions, of course, is the label that we're on. Thank you, Dave Collins, our editor, and all the team back in Melbourne. And a final big thank you to Catherine Brunt. This has been The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon. Talk to you again soon. I had to go.